It's rolling, I can begin. Today is October 31st, 2010. I want to say hello to the wonderful students in front of me and to the many listening all over the world. And I just want to state, I thank you for your very warm comments on my shiurim. I'm talking to those all over the world, and the Ebishter should give strength. I should be able to go many chayil el chayil. Okay. Now, we started a most fascinating series. As I said, this is not a series for someone who hasn't been exposed to learning. It's more of a luxury. It's more of a dessert. But it is an amazing topic. And Lahagdil Torah Lahadira, I want to do it afterwards. Many months from now, I'm coming in to the most major topic of all that will take another 20 years. How do we paskin halacha? But this is Lahagdil Torah Lahadira, and the Besamim Rosh, any Talmud Chacham is so fascinated. Was he real? Wasn't he real? Are the Chuvot accurate? Is it the Rosh? Who is Rav Shaul Berlin? If he lied, why did he have to lie in this fashion? Why couldn't he come clean? And the questions of the Besamim Rosh continue until this moment. I'm going to continue with the introduction now. I'll continue next week. Ultimately, I'm going to come to the actual Shuvat of the Besamim Rosh and show you halachically and hashkafically and historically exactly what was troubling him and why he acted the way he acted. But let's come back now to the whole question. We spoke about his life last week. His life itself is very fascinating. He was the son of Rav Zvi Hirsch Berlin. Actually, the name is Levin, but because his father was the Rebbe of Berlin, he was called Rav Zvi Hirsch Berlin. His father was a cousin to the Nodav Yehuda, and he came from this tremendous, what you would call today, in modern terminology, Haredi background. In American slang, you would call it a black background. I'm not using these words in a pejorative sense, but in a descriptive sense. You understand? That's very important, because I don't want to be pejorative at all. Those of you who know my own hashkafa know that it's very different than black, white, and labels. And we have to understand the black is here to stay, the white is here to stay. We have to learn how to live properly with each other. But he came from this background, and you saw from the years he lived, the 1700s, paralleling basically the life of Moshe Mendelssohn. He was caught up in Haskalah, he was attracted to Haskalah. Today, anyone who's attracted to Haskalah, you have Yeshiva University, you have Ne'er Yisrael, Satma, every Satma Yeshiva has a high school. You can go to Touro, you can go to Lander, in the state of Israel, here we have different problems. You have to do Ami, as Meir Lichtenstein said so correctly. Ami here is the equivalent of college. But nevertheless, even in the Ami, you can do this type of Hezda, that type of Hezda, Nachal Haredi, regular Ami. There's so many options, and there's a lot of education in the Ami too. Those of you who have done Ami know what I'm talking about, and no one knows it better than I do, because for 14 and a half years I did Miluim after my basic training, and I was a lecturer in a very unique school, the highest level of teaching of the rabbinate, called the Midrashat Haranit in Tel Aviv. And until today I meet people who tell me they're only Shomer Shabbos because of lectures they heard from me 20, 30 years ago. So the Ami is very unique. After which you can go on, you have so much choice. You can go to university, you can go to Machon Lev, you can go to Haredi College, you can go to Lander College, you can go to Torah College, all in the state of Israel. But Nebuch, Rav Shaul Berlin, had no choice. And he was what you call in modern language a closet maskil. And of course, I left you with the question that I'm never really going to be able to give an answer to. But it's a very fascinating question. If he were alive today, would he be the Rosh Yeshiva at YU or the Rosh Yeshiva at Chobevei Torah? And that is a question that keep in back of your mind as we deal with the Besamim Rosh. Now, I showed you early in life, and we'll come back to this much later today, He wrote a pamphlet anonymously attacking Robert Falcone. Robert Falcone was a great rub, the rub of Ahu, of three great communities, Atlona and Hamburg and Landsbeck, and he was a gonad there, and here an attack comes out against him. The book was put into Cherem. He published it anonymously, underlined the word anonymously, because you see this trend within Rav Shaul Berlin. Afterwards, his father finds out it's his son who wrote the book. Remember, I explained that to you last week, the play on words, that it's Shaul Iti. And the father defends the son, and other Gedolim defend the son. It becomes a cause celebre. But he already has a reputation that he writes anonymously, and that he is caught up in Haskalah. Now, when the Besamer Rosh comes out, he writes an entire introduction, comes up with a beautiful story. The story, you know, is beyond words. What is the story about? That he found this manuscript in Italy, he bought it in Italy. These people in Italy, it's a manuscript that a few hundred years earlier, Yitzchak di Modena, they come up with a name, a fabricated name, that he found the manuscript, he copied the manuscript, and the Chibur are attributed to the Rush and to his contemporaries. The Sefer appears, and a tremendous storm breaks out, and this storm reverberates until today. Is it legitimate? Isn't legitimate? Did he make it up? He writes a super commentary on the Besamer Rosh, the Kasada Hasana, which I'll explain to you, but not yet. And he writes a super commentary, and the Noda Yehuda wrote Haskama, his father, Reb Tzvi Hishpavin, wrote Haskama, and other Gedolim attack him very ritual, very caustically, let me put it that way. Now, can you depend upon him? Can't you depend upon him? So I showed you a source, a beautiful source in Mo'adim B'Halacha. We ended off the class last week. And I, as I mentioned to you, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin was one of a kind. We don't have people like that in this generation. I was just privileged to know Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. And what can I tell you? He was a Chabad Chassid from the old school, from White Russia. He knew Kol HaTorah Kula Ba'al Peh, had a photographic memory, was Chassidish Jew, a Litvish Lamdin. He understood Reb Chaim, he understood all the Litvish innovations in learning, and he was a great Zionist and a great Mizrahiite. And he introduced a new form of writing. Those of you familiar with the Encyclopedia Talmudica, it's revolutionized the world of writing Torah. If we have today Shmirat Shabbat Yehuchata and another 1,000 Svarim written in an organized fashion with footnotes, with an index, you have to thank Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. The man was unbelievable. I had the privilege of knowing him because my neighbor, who lived one flight under me in Rav Chaim Berlin 18, was Rav Yehoshua Hutner, and through Rav Hutner, who worked, he was his right hand, I knew Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Okay, now, as Yitzchak just said, I'm almost about finished reviewing last week's lecture. What did I cite to you? I cited Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, Mo'adim B'Halacha, discusses eating kidneyot on Pesach. And in that topic, which is very fascinating, he quotes the Besamer Rosh. And he says the Besamer Rosh was adamant that Ashkenazim have to eat kidneyot on Pesach. It says the Rosh, the great Rishon, wrote this, and there's nothing wrong with eating kidneyot. And of course, then the question arises, can you depend upon the Besamer Rosh? Is this Taka a Rush? Is this a Rishon? Can we depend upon it? If we can depend upon it, David, you know how many problems would be solved. Pesach comes to Israel. What goes on here with Ashkenazim and Sfardim, what goes on here with Hechsherim, what goes on here with hotels. Oh, would it be Mashiach sight if the Ashkenazim and Sfardim could eat together on Pesach. So he raises the issue and he says about the B'Semen Rosh, and you'll see that this is widely quoted, and this is what I ended off last week's lecture with. Reb Shaul Levin Shekidroa Ima Maskilim Har Berlinian. Now, Berlinian, let me teach you modern Hebrew. In modern Hebrew there's a word, Tzvonim, Northerners. Believe me, Danny, if you would speak Hebrew in New York and use the word Tzvonim, no one would know what you are talking about. Ephraim, Tzvonim is Israeli slang for the North Tel Aviv crowd, Ramat Aviv, that crowd. They know nothing about Yiddishkeit. They're totally successful Israelis who are the quote rakefet, inverted Maranos. Anusim hafuchim. You know what that means? On the outside they're Israelis, on the inside they have no Jewish values. And this is a new word that was coined, Tzvonim. And it's a very powerful word, and those of us who understand the word, I don't have to say one additional word. Omrim alav hu tzvoni. You understand? You come to a house of mourning, he's sitting on a couch, he's not sitting low, he's not even wearing a yarmulke. People are expressing condolences, kissing him, hugging him, shaking hands. We understand everything that's universal, but not Jewish. That's a tzvoni. There's a book, you can read all about it. I recommend the book to you, Mikimi, by Noah Dayan Mikimi. I'm just trying to think. She has her maiden name there and her married name in the book. She's Noah Dayan is the final name. There's a middle name I'm missing, but okay. It'll come to me. Anyway, that book, she's a Bala Tshuva. She was a very famous TV radio personality. And she wrote a beautiful memoir that's called Mikimi. There's a chain of stores, I don't know if she owns it or part of it, that sells tzniyistic clothes, and it's called Mikimi. Tzniyistic clothes for women. Mikimi may offer dal, may ashpot yarim evyon. And that is Noah Dayan's book. Now, the word Berlinium, if you hear the word, he's a Berliner. That word in rabbinic Hebrew 200 years ago, 150 years ago, was a synonym for a maskil. If you lived in Berlin, you were suspected of being a maskil, enlightened, a follower of Mendelssohn. So that's what Rav Zevin calls Rav Shaul Berlin. He says he was friendly with the Berlin crowd. Noah Yaron Dayan. Okay? That's the name. She was famous under the name Noah Yaron. Later she married. It's an amazing book. I highly recommend it. What's said is they can't use the book in Beis Yaakov because she talks about her life before she became frum, and there's certain things in there in Beis Yaakov they don't want the girl to see. I don't agree with that type of chinuch, but that's the Beis Yaakov chinuch, not the type that I would espouse. Okay, I just want to end off this quote from Mordim B'Halacha, and it's very important, everyone quotes it, because he says, when it comes to the Summim Rosh, what is important is what he is saying, not who said it. And this becomes critical. What are you saying? Not who said it. Now, just to end off the question, let me go one step further. Just to end off the question of eating kidney up on Pesach, you see, Rav Zevin is intellectually totally honest. He doesn't want to dismiss the B'Semen Rosh. You can't say he's totally incorrect. And he quotes what I believe I mentioned to you last week, the Chacham Tzvi. And all of you know, Reb Tzvi, he is Ashkenazi, wrote a tshuva, crying, mourning, why can't we eat kidneyot on Pesach? And no one will suspect Reb Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi, the Chacham Tzvi, of being a Berliner. He lived before the Berlin crowd. And he was totally in favor. You remember what I told you, that he cried, Chai V'Kayim, that we eat chametz on Pesach because we don't eat kidneyot. And I explained that to you. Okay. Let me go one step further till we come to the heart of today's Shaira. Gentlemen, I'm about to get into a lot of trouble with the Haredim, with the black world. Yitzhak is already joyful. Rabbi Rubin, I am now quoting Reb Nassim Kamenetsky, Making of a Gadol. All right. Yossi, Making of a Gadol. I own, Baruch Hashem, I hope it doesn't go online. At that moment, I'll lose a fortune of money. Herbie, Making of a Gadol by Rabbi Nathan Kamenetsky. You've heard about the book?
No.
Oh my gosh. Put into Cherem 1 week after it appeared. Made the New York Times 6-column headline.
Any relation to Rabbi Yaakov?
Only his son. And the book is about his father. Making of a Gadol. I'm quoting from the improved edition. Got to be very careful here. Volume 1, page 183. Okay, I just have to be careful because the pagination changes slightly from the original edition to the improved edition. So this is... Excuse me? I understand. No. I often say the improved edition is worse than the first. If you've read the introduction, you understand what I mean. But he left one thing out in the second edition. I told you what he left out. Yeah, if you have him, okay, so I'll tell you what he left out. He left out one thing. Reb Aaron Cutler, when Reb Yisrael Zalman Meltzer died in 1953, Reb Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, Reb Aaron Cutler's father-in-law, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim. So Yeshiva at Eitz Chaim appointed Reb Aaron Cutler the titular Rosh Yeshiva. In other words, what do I mean by that, Eitan? They understood, Reb Aaron is living in America, but he would come during the summer to give Shayurim. In those days, you could not fly to Israel directly. So you generally flew to England, and from England, you flew to Israel. And Reb Aaron flew home via England, stopped off, spent some time there, knew Reb Aaron is in London, he has to give Shayurim. So Reb Aaron gave his Shayurim in London, and someone with a red beard, you know, and with all due respects to London, they're not exactly Gdolei Yisrael living there. It's Gold is Green, it's Hendon, it's Stamford Hill, it's Manchester, but with all due respects, it's not yet Brooklyn, and it's not yet Lakewood, and it's certainly not Yerushalayim. So a fellow with a red beard asked the question. He's no longer alive. People in London told me that they know exactly who it is. He asked the question, and if you knew Reb Aaron, I don't want to shock anyone, but if you've read memoir literature of the Yudapeyeshu Yeshiva, there would be terrible fights between the Rosh Yeshiva, the Talmidim. They would shoot at him, they would shoot back, they would maledict each other. It's called Mitzvah the Oraita. When I went to Lakewood, I was shocked. I mean, I went to Lakewood, how dare a student speak back to Reb Aaron Cutler? But that was the reality. YU is different. I never yet saw a student cut off the rub with a strong word. So this redhead asked the question with a red beard, and Reb Aaron thundered back at him, Vasaitia, Apara Aduma? Okay? So in the first edition, Reb Nassim had this story anonymously. The family went ballistic. They said everyone in England knows, and they insisted he take it out of this improved edition. All I can tell you is, If Rav Aaron Cutler called me a paraduma, I'm a red cup, I should have a red cup, I should have a red beard, I would be the happiest, proudest guy in the world. I once played for the Kollel. They came up, Yitz, I think you were here, they came up with a tape from the mid-50s where the Rav calls me a reform rabbi. And remember that? And I was the happiest guy alive, the plates for the Kollel. And I was furious at my classmates. No one defends me. The Rav called me a reform rabbi. I was saying a svara. I don't know. He got all upset with the svara. So what are you, a reform rabbi? And no one defends me. I was shut down. But that the Rav called me a reform rabbi makes me extremely proud that at least to hit Hashem. Okay. So that's the difference between the first edition and the improved. But the introduction is different. The introduction to the second edition already is very caustic and sharp and makes certain references that it's not for now to go into. Now, on page 183, he describes Reb Rafal HaKohen. Leave it to Reb Nosson Kamenetsky that he does his research and he comes up with the family name, Reb Rafal Rappaport. Just let me tell you, if anyone will use the name Reb Rafal Rappaport, no one will know who you're talking about. The whole world knows him as Reb Rafal HaKohen. And he describes the Machloket and he tells the following story. I don't know if it's true or not. Reb Rafal authored 2 volumes of response to Torah Chikutiel, Vishav HaKohen, because he was an authoritative and influential combatant of the Haskalah. It had begun to rear its head in Germany in his time. The Maskilim hired Reb Shaul Levine, the very learned son of the Berlin Rav, the Gaon Reb Hirsch Levine, to write an anonymous rebuttal of some of Reb Rafal's halakhic rulings under the name Mitzpeh Yokteel. Now, you see, I don't know whether these facts are correct, but according to Nosson Kamenetsky, the Maskilim hired Reb Shaul to write the volume. The author showed his true colors later by publishing a book of newly discovered responsa of the Rishon Rabbeinu Asher called B'Semen Rosh, an expert forgery about which my father, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, is referring to, once said, and this is the quote, don't
what
you...
What period of time did that
happen? The late... No, we're talking the early 17... The late 1700s, 1793. The early 1700s. But we're talking in the 18th century. And the B'Semen Rosh, and he's now quoting Reb Yaakov. Do you think just we were fooled? Even Rabbi Akiva was fooled. And he's quoting his father that the B'Semen Rosh was such a fabulous forgery that not just people like Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, who were going in, but not Rabbi Akiva Eger, that even Rabbi Akiva Eger was fooled. He's quoting his father. He has a footnote. Remember I told you last week that the B'Semen Rosh was published 3 times. The third time, 1984, 1983 in Jerusalem. It is interesting that an author in Jerusalem republished B'Semen Rosh in 1984, 190 years after its first publication, and even offered a defense for the nefarious author. So you can see that Reb Nosson Kamenetsky is in a state of shock that it was reproduced. I had showed you the volume last week, and we had it right before our eyes. Gentlemen, with that in mind, we have arrived at a major junction. Godomi Rabban Shimon. You give me your first name?
Yeah, Rafi.
Rafi Strauss. Okay, and one second, let me just... this is Eli Schwartz, and we're getting this early, what do we do? You guys can't figure out, you're not technicians. Eli Schwartz, Rafi Strauss, David Deutscher. We're missing Rimmler. Menachem Rimmler is not here. I've heard that excuse from 500 guys in the Kollel. Don't tell it to me. That's like saying, Rebbe, your classes are a waste of time. The knowledge you're giving is useless. Forget it. Okay.
When hired him, he's talking as if there was a cabal of Maskewim.
I would imagine.
There is a literature of that.
If the Maskilim hired him, it would have to be proved. No, no one has been able to prove it. But someone who does a doctorate has to research it thoroughly. Then the Maskilim hire anyone else, you know, you have to be able to research it. But Reb Nesson Kamenetsky is repeating what he heard from his father, what he heard in Tei Rav Das, what he heard in Lakewood, and that's the way they dismiss it. Now, gentlemen, the greatest posek in our generation, the greatest posek alive, is, of course, Rav Ovadia Yosef. Here, too, I have the schut that I know him quite well. I've spoken learning with him. I taught his daughter. I have inscribed offsets from him. And there isn't a posek like him. I don't know if we'll ever see a posek like Rav Ovadia again. He is a throwback to earlier generations.
He was more.
Excuse me.
He's at
90. He still has it. I'll comment on what you're saying. One second. I know what you're saying. His knowledge, his ability to paskin, his understanding of psak. There is no literature posek today who has Rav Ovadia's understanding of psak. To know what psak is about. I mean, there's certain things going on. I'm not going to go into it now, but you should know it's Reform Judaism in the name of Halakha. Just as Rabbi Rachman, to save Agunot, went out of his way to... why does this give us the trouble? Last time it started an hour and 20 minutes in, but this is the third time already. Is there something the matter here?
Stand
on the
book.
Yeah, maybe bribery
off the
test. I want a book out.
Do we have a book to put it on?
What about?
Okay, all right. Rabbi Ovadia as a posek is second to none, just as Rabbi Rachman. In my opinion, try to reform Judaism to accommodate the Aguna, which is a terrible problem. Today you have Litvisha reforming Judaism with the concept of retroactive annulment of Gerib, which is totally a non-halachic concept. So Rav Ovadia is one of a kind. The problem that Herbie is alluding to is besides being the great posek, besides being the great Rav Ovadia, he's also a popular speaker who deals with a certain type of audience and clientele. He's a dashen par excellence, and at times he makes statements that, to put it into popular language, he flies off the handle. So, and the reporters here have a field day. Every Motzei Shabbos, they have endless reporters at the Bukharan shul where he speaks, and everyone is looking for, let's see, Rav Ovadia, what will he say today? What headline will he give us? What can we perpetuate and put onto the radio, the TV, the newspapers? But you have to differentiate. There's Rav Ovadia, the popular speaker, Hayored Ha'am, and there's Rav Ovadia, the great posek. Now, I want to take a classic shiva of Rav Ovadia, written in Cairo, written in Egypt, where he was Rebbe in Egypt when he started out. He was a Talmud in Yerushalayim, and from Podat Yosef and from Yerushalayim, they called him to Egypt to be the Av Beit Din there. And this is Shelatun Shivat Yabia Omer, Chelik Sheni, Volume 2. I'm quoting from Siman Chaf Dalet, 24, written in Cairo, Tasha, which would be 1950. Now, this is a classic shaila that comes up time and again in the rabbinate, time and again in life. Rav Ovadia has to deal with a suicide. Tells the following story. There was a man who lost his possessions, lost his investments, lost his money. Now, those of us who have never been rich, well, you can't appreciate this. Well, you're not rich, you struggle. There were times in my life I had to count agorot. All right, thank God today I mentioned, I forget to whom, one of my grandsons, thank God I have enough money for, for bread and water. So my grandson corrected me, he said for bread and soda. Because my grandchildren always say that they always come to our home because soda is always available, whereas in their homes it's only on Shabbos that they have soda. So I said, Baruch Hashem. But if you've been rich and had the power of money, if you could do whatever you want, and then you lose it all, you are a candidate for suicide. It's very sad, and you know, during the Depression, how many people jumped. You know, even now, there were quite a few suicides of people who lost it all in the terrible recession that we're living through, particularly in the United States. Thank God in Israel, we have rebounded. So, Rav Ovadia deals with this guy. He jumped from the roof of a tall building. He died immediately. And of course, the Shaila is, do you mourn for him? Do you have Hilchat Aveilut? Do you mourn for him? Now, Al Pi Halacha, someone who commits suicide, essentially there is no mourning, we have to make an example, the man is a murderer, he murdered himself, it's like a person who smokes. A person who smokes is a murderer. He's murdering himself. And you should tell that to anyone who smokes, Al Pi Halacha, he has a din of Eron Seach. He's a murderer.
I smoke.
Don't smoke. You're not allowed to smoke. I'll call up a doctor for you, and I'll arrange for you to see an autopsy of a lung of a person who smoked, and the autopsy, you can see two autopsies, a person who didn't smoke and a person who does smoke. And you'll look at the lungs, and believe me, you will never touch a cigarette again. The lung of the smoker is...
Cigar,
I don't know. I can only talk about cigarettes. Anyway, be it as it may, I see all these yeshiva boys from Hebron outside the building smoking. If I had guts and time to waste, I would walk by and tell them, Atem rotzchim et atzmechem, atem ma'abdim et atzmechem ladat. So me'ikin hadin, you're not even allowed to bury him on the cemetery. You bury him separately, and I've told you more than once that I had a colleague who got smicha with me, Bernie Cohn. I trust that Rabbi Rubin remembers Bernie Cohn, and Bernie...
Don't touch it.
No, I'm trying. I hear an echo, and it's disturbing. Tomorrow I'll play with my microphone. I think it's better. Anyway, so Bernie Cohn became a rabbi. Afterwards, he became a PhD, a criminologist, a professor. But when he was in the rabbinate, he was a rabbinate in a place right near Atlantic City that was once a Jewish colony. I believe it was Jamestown, Jamesburg, if I'm not mistaken. And I went to visit Bernie a number of times, and he showed me the cemetery. Why do you think that should make a difference?
That I didn't bother you in the past?
That, yeah, that's correct. You're right. Right, let's see. Okay. That may be the solution. But we have to find out why such an expensive mechanism causes problems. Okay, good. So, thank you. So, Bernie took me to see the cemetery. It may be Mount Freedom, near Ginsburg. I think it was called Mount Freedom. It was originally a Baron D. Hirsch agricultural colony out of the mid-late 1800s. And the cemetery was an ancient Jewish Orthodox cemetery. And as we approached the cemetery, we saw graves outside the cemetery. And I asked Bernie, what are these? And he said, oh, the old timers told me this is a suicide, this is a prostitute, this is a murderer. And these were all Jews who disgraced the community, they were not buried with regular Jews. Now, as time moved on, and you're going to see this in the B'Samim Rosh, and you're going to see it in contemporary Tshuvot, here we have an interesting development where halacha lemaisa, you do not find anyone deemed a suicide today. The reason is very simple. We know psychology today. We are more up to date in medical practice, psychology, and of course, Rafi, no one in his right mind commits suicide. I saw three rabbis before my eyes basically commit suicide. A very sad commentary. But each one, once I knew the psychology, one of them had just lost a job. He was fired. He's teaching English in Boys Town. His brother was a world famous rabbi, and he couldn't even hold a job as an English teacher. Committed suicide. There was another suicide. Very prominent brothers, and he was a lo yutzlachnik, and whatever he did, he had difficulty. Another suicide. Just got a PhD teaching at Michlala, and they terrible problems with the administration. Lost all his dignity, self-respect. Jumped right past my window. Gentlemen, are these people deemed culpable, guilty? All three committed suicide wearing kippah. And we know from psychology that what can we do? People are schizophrenic, people are bipolar, people are depressed, people lose their self-respect. I can tell you I did some research, this goes back to the early 70s, and those of you who are going to study or have studied psychology will find that there's a tremendous rate of suicide among men in their late 40s, early 50s, spring time of year. Why? Because at that age they realize they haven't made it. They have problems. Springtime, the whole world is renewing. Spring is here. Music in the air. Love is in the air. And they're in a rut, unsuccessful. They jump. It's second only to the rate of suicide among teenagers. I don't have to tell you, among teenagers, there you have a tremendous problem, men and women. But here we're talking about men. At the research in the 70s, and it may have changed today, women who have children are fulfilled. They're not going to commit suicide. Their mothers, their grandmothers, they have a role in life. They have a purpose in life. Chava, v'hi ein kol chai. Now, if this is the case, then as our knowledge expands psychologically, then of course we can be lenient when it comes to suicides. And here you have a tshuvat harash, which is very, very lenient in relation to suicide. And we'll come to that tshuva. But Rebbe Avadya, when answering the question, has to deal with the B'Samim Rosh, a Tshuvat HaRashim and the Tshuvat of the B'Samim Rosh. You follow me? And Rebbe Avadya has to deal with it. And I'm now quoting from the middle of this tshuva that the Chatam Sofer considered a suicide. And he brought a raya that you're not allowed to bury a suicide properly. He quotes the story about Rav Hananya ben Chajon, that he refused to open his mouth when the Romans were executing him. They were willing to put the flames into his mouth. He should die quicker and not suffer. And he said, no, I cannot allow myself to be killed quicker. I have to do what I can to live longer. And the Chatam Sofer says, what do you see from there? Shafilu misha makes up the yoter arsulo la'abed et atzmo ledat. Even if you are suffering immensely, you cannot commit suicide. And the Chatam Sofer quotes the Besamim Rosh and says, Shebezen Nizdayef, it is phony, it is false, it is a malicious forgery, and you cannot quote the Besamim Rosh. And Rabbi Ovadia goes on and he quotes from contemporaries of the Besamim Rosh that there are things written there that you cannot believe Rabbanoteinu HaRishonim Kamalachim could say such things. And the whole nation spoke against the person who wrote it, Reb Shaul Berlin, and he quotes the Maharam Bennett, he quotes other people, and even though he was the son of Shachagong, Reb Zvi Hirsch Berlin, but nevertheless, what he wrote is totally false. And Reb Ovadia quotes from a sefer written at that time, that the Besamim Rosh got involved with philosophy. Philosophy is a synonym for Haskalah, and that totally ruined his head. And he wrote things, sometimes clearly, sometimes hinting at it, and I will show you this is true. Kotvim Besod, Hamaskil Yavim, and he wrote concepts which are totally opposed to the Torah. And Reb Shaul Berlin, you cannot quote him. So you see, his first point when it comes to suicide and quoting the Besamim Rosh, he quotes Svarim that were totally, completely, absolutely opposed to the Besamim Rosh. On the other hand, this is what's amazing. Menachem, you have arrived. That doesn't Rabbi Ovadia is from Yerushalayim. He only
went. Well, he was started, but the Rambam believed in philosophy.
No, Poseidon, that's a different era. But then you went into the Dark Ages. You're talking about the Ashkenazim. They went into the ghetto, and the Besamim Rosh, Haskalah, and enlightenment. You have to hear my lectures. They're on the website. The years ago I spent.
That's why I came here.
So, you know, but that's a whole year worth of lectures that, Be'ezrat Hashem, if I give it again, it'll be when I'm 120 because I have so much more to teach to them. Now.
Can you talk about
Shalom Hamelach? Excuse me? Can you talk about Shalom Hamelach? No. I spoke about Shalom Hamelach in great depth in the Holocaust. No. That isn't brought in now. But now. You know who defended the Besamim Rosh? You see, Rabbi Ovadia can't get away with only quoting the Chatam Sofer, only quoting Reb Mordechai Bennett. Rabbi Ovadia knew too much. The Litvisha, you take Reb Moshe, you take my Rebbe if he had to answer a question, they would quote what they thought was correct and what fit into their svara. Rabbi Ovadia knows too much. See, he can't get away with this. He knows that the great Chidah, Rabbi Yosef David Azulai, defended the Besamim Rosh and considered the Besamim Rosh absolutely accurate. And he came out and he gives all the sources here. You'll see one source after another. And he goes on that there's no one in the world who would go and falsify words and say it's the Rush, say it's a Rishon, and he goes on. And he says, this man, the son of Reb Zvi Hirsch Berlin, the cousin of the Nodav Yehuda, Chas v'chalila, that you would say that it is a forgery. And he goes on, the Chidah, defending the Besamim Rosh. Now, something amazing here. So Rav Ovadia has on one hand the Chatam Sofer, on the other hand the Chidah, But Rabbi Vajra is Rabbi Vajra.
Why did he do that, considering that he himself recognizes from some emotions of literary torture?
Who said that Rabbi Vajra recognizes?
But did he think it was a real book?
We'll see what he has to say. But he's quoting what he's quoting the Chidah. Rabbi Avadya can't dismiss the Chidah. This is it was a cousin to the Nodav Yehuda. It's Rabbi Cheskel Landau, the Nodav Yehuda. But there's something amazing here. See, we take Rabbi Avadya, we wouldn't give him credit for having Chachmat Yisrael, a scientific mind. Rabbi Avadya writes here. I'm puzzled. Who is right? But he says something amazing. He says, but we're living in a different period. And I remind you, he's writing this in 1950. We are finding manuscripts in all the libraries. We're finding ancient Kitvei Yad. We have never yet found a Ktav Yad from the Besamim Rosh. In other words, what did Rav Shobalin say? He said he bought a copy in Italy of a manuscript that was copied by Rav Yitzchak di Molina. Where's the original? Shouldn't it have surfaced? But look at the finesse that shows that Rav Avadya is aware of libraries. Kitvei Yad. This man is right with it, right on top of it. I can tell you in parentheses. Everyone quotes Rakefet that the Rav never indulged in Chochmat Yisrael. All right. I've said it many times. It's not entirely true. The Rav had an uncle, Rav Menachem Karakovsky. We're going to talk about it Shabbat. I'm going to blow your minds with what I discovered just a few weeks ago in my car. Rav Menachem Karakovsky, you've heard the name, was the Magid Meshurim Vilna. Was a Golan Adir. You're familiar with the Avodat HaMelech and the first part of the Rambam. That's all that remains of his. The rest of the manuscript was lost in the Holocaust. Rav Menachem Karakovsky has a scientific approach, feeling for manuscripts. Who did he ask to check the manuscripts in the major libraries in Berlin for alternate readings? The Rav. I don't recall already. I found four, then I found six. I asked Rebbe, this was my last meeting with the Rav in this world, 1983. And the Rav already was on in years and aging and sick, but his mind was good that day. And he asked me to come back with him to his apartment. I helped carry him. It was very sad for me to see my Rebbe in that condition. And among the questions I asked him, Rebbe, you look for manuscripts, Kitvei Yad, variant readings for your uncle. And the Rebbe's face lit up like a little kid. I said, how many times does he quote you? Four times. You should know, I had a student, Rabbi Dr. Yosef Klausner in the Kollel. I said, Klaus, I got a little assignment for you. I found two. Find the four. He found six. Ultimately, I found eight. There's a guy in Bnei Brak who teaches at Bar Ilan, who's a Talmud of the Rav, who's very big in this aspect, and he found eight. In my footnote, in my work on the Rav, I think I give you eight different examples where they looked at the Kitvei Yad. And I quoted it in my lectures in the Shoah. It played a role with the Hilchot Yesodei Torah, with Mesirat Nefesh, with giving your life, with the whole Machlokes, Rish Lakish, Rav Yochanan. I quoted the Rav. So you see that sometimes we're very primitive. We are, because we think Gee, the Rav, yeah, it was kulo brisk, it's true. But there certainly was an appreciation, at least at one time in his life, for Kitvayat. I can't say it lasted a lifetime, because I know I heard on a tape, and I had a, it was an unbelievable story, the Yarche Kollel in Boston in the early 70s, that has to be 75. So that's when the first volume of the Frankel Rambam appeared on Hilchot, what do you call it, Zmanim, I believe, on Shabbat, etc. And I'm listening to the tape of the Yarche Kollel in Boston, and the Rav, you know, it's not the way we come to class, everything's there, everything ready. I do this on purpose, because I don't want to be like the Rav. Every time I need a sefer, bring me a sefer, bring me a Rambam, bring me a Gemara. We used to lose 20 minutes of Shia with messengers going up and down from the first floor to the Gottesman Library and the second floor. But today, Baruch Hashem, we have Xerox machines. It's a pleasure, particularly I have material here, which you're not going to get in the library. So, the Rav, one second, I started to tell a story. So, the Rav asked for a Rambam, Hilchas Shabbos. So someone from the audience passes up a Rambam. The Rav opens it, you hear it on the tape. It's Yarche Kollel, it must be 75, the year that the Rambam appeared, the first volume, the Frankel. And the Rav says, no, nishta za Rambam, not like this. I can't look at it. Little avash of a Rambam. So then they passed up a Warsaw Rambam. Oh, the Rav said, this is the Rambam I'm used to. It's the Rambam I grew up on. So you see what he could do in the 1920s, he couldn't handle in the 1970s. Now you should know, this caused a course of lever. In my advanced class in Michalan, I had a woman, she should live and be well. She's in her 90s today, one of the most brilliant people I ever taught. She came to every class of mine. She was the librarian of the Knesset, Dr. Shulamit Hakatan. Very famous family. Her husband's a Zichrono Livracha. They got married at the start of World War II and laughed at them. What are you getting married? Every Jew will be killed. When her husband died, there were over, I believe, 200 direct descendants from the family. I taught her children. I taught her daughters-in-law. And they're from France originally, running away from Hitler. And she was the librarian of the Knesset, and she attended my advanced class for years, because I don't repeat lectures. So when I told the story of the Rav with the Rambam for years, she said to me, she can't believe it, she can't believe it, such a great mind. What do you mean he didn't look at the Frankel? How can you look at an old Warsaw edition? Frankel has come out. But I understand her, and I understand the Rav. When you get used to something, it's very hard. When I look at what you guys study with, the art scroll, Talmud, the Schottenstein, Ribbono Shel Olam, five pages of the same Amud, a little translation here, a little translation here, a little there, Ribbono Shel Olam, till the time you finish Shas, you'll have 50 beards, not one beard. So, but look at Rav Ovadia, that Rav Ovadia seems now to indicate the Chatam Sofer is correct. If there would have been a Besamin Rosh manuscript, we should have discovered it by now. And he quotes the Chatam Sofer, how the Chatam Sofer wrote against the Besamin Rosh. He called it not Besamin Rosh, but Kisvei HaRosh, lies attributed to the Rosh, a scandal, a nefarious deed, falsehood, Kisvei HaRosh. It's a play, it's a double intender. It's more than a double intender, it's a triple intender. It's a play on Besamim Rosh, it's Kisvei Rosh. And we would say in Hebrew, Kitvei HaRosh, you follow? So it's Kisvei HaRosh, the lies. And then he quotes Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. And you see, this is Rav Ovadia. I challenge you to find that in the 1990s or the 2000s, a Litvisha Posek from the Haredi world with, quote, Reb Shlomo Yosef Zeffen. But in the Sfadik world, their breakthrough, their broadness, goes from east to west, north to south. And with great derech eretz, he calls HaRav HaGon Yedidi, HaRav HaGon HaMafusam, Reb Shlomo Yosef Zeven Shlita. And he quotes the Moadim B'Halacha, exactly what I quoted to you, and he too reaches the conclusion, the Ein Lamedim B'Sefer Zeh, Ela Mitzapa Amur, the Lo Mitzad Mi She'amram. And he says, V'chein Ani Omer, Shal Kol Panim Mila Maila Teide Yit Beit Ashinin Lohu. Wow. So Rabbi Ovadia says, we can learn if it's good. He doesn't put Rav Shobel in the Cherub, but he cuts him down to size. It's an Akram. It's not the Rush. It's not who we claim said it. It's rather what he said. And Rav Ovadia agrees with Rav Shlomo Yosef Zeven.
What year was the
Moadim B'Halacha? Moadim B'Halacha had to come out in the mid-50s. It was written before with articles in Hatsofer.
He's
citing, yeah. So the Moadim B'Halacha, very interesting. You're saying that he wrote the Tshuva in 1950. I don't think the Sefer was out yet, but the series may have very well appeared in Hatsofer. And when he edited it for publication, he put in the source of, that's a very good point, Malcolm, very good. Yes.
What's wrong about his reason for saying we can learn somebody who didn't have any respect for the Rishonim?
Well, you are adding the word didn't have any respect. We can look at it another way, that he had so much respect that he realized if he says it in his name, no one will listen. But if he says it in the name of the Rush, people will listen. But to say that,
such a stretch, though. You're saying it in somebody else's name. You're besmirching their
name. Ellie, that's what the Chatam Sofer said.
But he wasn't the only one. It was very common.
Middle Ages. Well, wait a second. Now, I want to show you something amazing. When Rav Ovadia finishes all this, and he comes down in favor of the Chatam Sofer, and he quotes from Shlomo Yosef Zeven, but you see, you can't escape the Chida, and he quotes his own Rebbe, HaRav HaGon, he was alive yet then, I still remember his funeral, HaRav Ovadia Hadaya, he was a Gon Adir, the Yas Kil Avdi. And you'll see the sources, I don't have to give you the sources, it's all in the Tshuva, the Abiyom is readily available, he quotes his Rebbe. And here you come back to what Eli alluded to. His Rebbe wrote, the Besamim Rosh has to be absolutely accurate and correct. Because it says the Tshuva assigned by the Rosh. And that's the greatest proof. So you see, what Rav Ovadia Hadaya is saying is very simple. If it says the Rush, who in the world would have the chutzpah, the asas panim, the arrogance to falsify a Rishon? Rishonim k'malachim. Who are we? This is not conservative Judaism now. I'll show you as... Excuse me, Rav Odar? He was Rebbe... What are you talking about? He was Rosh Yeshiva of Paret Yosef.
So what?
He
makes an absolute God.
It's what are you talking about? It's Rav Ovadia Yosef's Rebbe.
So what?
You just heard the same thing from Eli. And
it's not what you just said. You just said it's not reform here. It is reform. He's a Moscow. That's reform.
I don't give him labels. But the answer is
that you can see the tamimut of Rabbi Ovadia Hadayim. And you see the beauty of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef that he can't escape quoting his Rebbe, and as much as he sides with the Chatam Sofer, and as much as he sides with Rav Zevin, but he can't escape quoting his Rebbe. And of course, the answer is very simple, that's the forgery, that he wrote the words of the Rush. But Rabbi Ovadia's mindset couldn't tolerate, Rabbi Ovadia Hadayah, who would dare to forge a ratio? Couldn't comprehend it. Nevertheless, Rabbi Ovadia accepts the fact that the sum of Rosh is a forgery. We don't dismiss him. We accept it as an achron. If there's something good, we accept it. And if there's something not good, we do not accept it. Now, let me go further. Halacha l'maaser in this case, at the end, Rabbi Ovadia says, there are other factors involved. And here you come to an interesting question that many times you will have this problem in the rabbinate. When it comes to Avelut, we have a klal, Halacha kedivrei hamekil ba'avelut. And this is true, we paskin. I can give you simple examples, which is Halacha l'maaser today. And there was a tremendous machloket achronim at the end of the 19th century, the Netziv and others. What happens today? Lo aleinu, a wonderful Rebbetzin died last week. Shendi Feuerstein. From Livingston. You can't imagine what a great person, what an isha gedola she was. How much she suffered, 8 years with that terrible disease that I hope, if you're not going to be a melamed, you should go into medicine and find a cure. Go into research. Can't conquer cancer. It's terrible. So they had a funeral in Livingston. I don't know how many of the children came, their 8 children, but I know one daughter was almost in labor.
I know.
And she remained behind. And now what's the shaila? When did she start shiva? She gave birth, 3 hours later. So not exactly she could sit shiva. But technically, it's very interesting. She could begin the shiva Monday afternoon. The body was sent to Israel. When was the funeral here? Tuesday afternoon, evening. Did they start shiva on Tuesday or Wednesday? Let's say for the sake of argument that they started shiva Wednesday. She gets up shiva 2 days earlier. You follow? Now, this is a very big question. When do you start shiva? You're not going to participate in the funeral. The body's being sent. The body's not buried yet. Was a tremendous machleket achronim 100 years ago. Today we paskin lahalacha, the minute you walk away from the funeral, shiva begins. Halacha kedivrei hamekel. Fine. So it's very easy to say someone committed suicide, halacha kedivrei hamekel, no shiva. No shiva. You follow me, Yossi? Very easy to say. Well, relax, Nachum, don't jump ahead. Let me explain it properly. You didn't say the key word. The key word here is there's another aspect to shiva. Pagam mishpacha. You know from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, there's a whole machlokes, what does it do? We'll come to a hesped in a minute. Yikudachai, yikudashichdei, is it for the living, for the dead? But one thing is certain. All the laws of Veilat are for the living as well. When people don't sit shiva, it's, you know, the family's disgraced. Pagam mishpacha, what kind of son? You know, the shayla always comes up, the son is not religious. We had a case in Israel where a very prominent a TV personality died, Ephraim Segel. And he was a Panovich yeshiva boy, you know, and there is a whole slew list of Panovich yeshiva boys who became totally irreligious. Very successful, but totally irreligious. Many of them TV personalities, radio personalities, authors, whatever the reasons are. I'm not overwhelmed by chinuch in the Haredi world because they also run a high percentage of failure. When they fail, they really fail. When we fail, all right, Mimela, it's a terrible thing, but sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't go that far. So his brother, Dan Segel, asked the Shaila and got a psak. He doesn't sit shiv. His brother's the famous mashkiach. Whoever paskin what he paskin, believe me, I wouldn't paskin that way, but he didn't sit shiva for his own brother. So look what happens. Everyone is talking about the family. Everyone knows the dirty linens are washed in public. The breach in the family is indescribable. How do you think the children feel of the late Ephraim Segel if they know their uncle, the great Mashgiach, is not sitting shiva? So that's what you call pagam mishpacha. Excuse me? Adopted kids sit shiva all the time, and I know one case where he was told not to sit shiva, and I consider that a tragedy of a psak, because there's no bracha levatala, and it's covered. You owe your parents to raise you and paid money and paid your tuition and taught you how to be a good Jew, and the world doesn't have to talk. People don't always know that this kid is adopted, this kid is not, this kid's from a previous
marriage. This means that the same way as there are doctors guilty of malpractice, there are rabbis.
Have it your way. But let me just deal with this here.
Call a spade a spade.
Yitzchak today is no longer the right winger he was last Monday. He is shifted slightly. Yes, my dear Yitzchak, hear this, kam mishpacha. So he does say, and he quotes the Chatam Sofer, that if already there is a suicide where you can find, as we said an hour ago, justifiable psychological reasons, then you don't want to harm the family, you don't want to embarrass the family, and the family is able to sit shiva. And he brings down examples from Achronim, Rabbi Abadi Yosef, where people try to commit suicide. Let's say they slit their wrists, and then they pleaded, bring a doctor. So even though they died, what does it show you? The fact that they pleaded, bring a doctor, shows that they had charata. And they regret what they did. And then you see the sources. The sources here are very fascinating. They bring down a Gilyon on the Shulchan Aruch from Rav Shaul Berlin's father, that if someone commits suicide by drowning, you don't drown right away. You go up and down, and it's impossible that a person shouldn't regret what he did while he's going up and down in the water. And they tell a story, brings down from a Chatam Sofer, that they actually heard a person declaring that he regrets he drowned himself. So in all these cases, you can be Megel and have them sit shiva. As far as ripping Kriya, there you don't make a bracha. However, and here we come to the most difficult problem you will ever have in the rabbinate. My dear young rabbis, you have to make a hesped. Fine. have to make a hesped? Oh, what does it matter? Make a hesped. Praise someone. Got a real problem here. Look into the Gemara Bracha, Daf Samech Bet, Amid Aleph. Rav Avadya quotes the Gemara, but I'll quote it to you. Famous Gemara. A maspid, who sabdana. These were professional eulogizers, like Magid, who like Batchan. A Batchan specializes, you hire him for your wedding, he tells jokes, right or wrong, he makes up rhymes. How many of you had a Batchan at your wedding? In the yeshivish world, I understand. The Hasidic world, I know 100%. You don't have a wedding without a Batchan. It's part of the ritual. I still remember in America with a Batchan, we used to call them gifts. Everyone made a pledge to the Chatan Bakala, and the Batchan let you have it if the gift wasn't enough. You understand? Listen, a young couple needs money. It's a chesed. So you have this eulogizer. By the way, David, I have to thank you. This is perfect. I don't understand it, because all this is a microphone. There's nothing electronic in here unless there's something we don't know. You follow? But what you did, leave it for tomorrow. Baruch Hashem. Perfect. Yashikayach. So, David Pardo is not only a Talmud Chacham, not only knows Yiddish, not only knows Ladino, but in this course they all have A's. Anyone who comes to class gets an A+. Also a computer genius and smart enough to marry a wonderful young lady. Okay. So, some of the men here have to take that lesson to heart. Now, so this Maspid was giving a Hesped in front of Rebbe Nachman, and he said about someone that who hayat sanua b'ochatav, that he was modest in the way he lived. And Rebbe Nachman called him aside and said, "What the heck are you talking about? Did you follow him into the bathroom to know whether he's modest or not? The entire sugya is in bracha on this, right? Did you follow him to the bathroom to know itzanua ilo? The Tanya ain't called in sanua elamisha sanua bebei pakisei." And I have to tell you, modern television, modern movies are a disgrace. They show you scenes in lavatories. Seinfeld, he has such a good head. Halavai, we could have gotten him in his teenage years and turned him on to Gemara and learning, and here at Shemayim, where he comes from, and his family, his mother's side, he'd be a Gadol Yisrael today. But that whole good head was wasted making billions of dollars on Narishkeit irresponsibility and scenes in bathrooms. Morons. I have no idea. All I can tell you is if he gave stuff, he should name the Kollel the Jerry Seinfeld Rakefet Kollel. Is there any other Rosh Yeshiva alive who knows every episode of those four Jews and what a horrendous, terrible, horrible message for the whole world? The four actors. The king. Who? Richard? He's not a Jew. I can't believe he's not a Jew. He acts like a Jew, looks like a Jew, named like a Jew. Forget it. And Dreyfus did not. No, no, no. Okay, let it be. How do you know, gentlemen? So, gentlemen. So he turns to Rav Nachman. He says, "Rebbe, what are you getting so mad about? What's the difference what I said?" I can assure you, Rabbis Reuben and Rothkopf officiated at a lot of funerals. And perhaps we gave praises where it didn't belong. I'll tell you a story in a second. But what are you getting so upset? So you praised him. It's like a Rebbe says to a kid who's an idiot, he says, "Wow, you're a bright fellow." All right, you have to do that at times. Give the kid encouragement. You got to encourage him. Fine. So the Gemara answers, Mishum Tanya, we learn, Kishem Shem Nifrayim Min Hametim, Kaf Nifrayim Min Hasvatnim. Umin ha'omim achareihem. Wow! God punishes the dead for their sins, and he punishes the eulogizers for their lies. When you eulogize, you have to be honest. The Rebbe always quoted this. You have to know how to eulogize. This is a tremendous Gemara. For practicing rabbis, it's the greatest challenge you will ever face. Because how do you do it? How do you eulogize? I was a nice fop, a trumpenick, a bum. So therefore, Rabbi Avadya says, to eulogize a suicide, better not to. And if I would tell you, la halacha, if you have to eulogize, hold on. If you have to eulogize, speak about his family, speak about his background, speak about his children. You don't have to speak about the mate Hamuta Lefanecha. He is only a small part of the story.
Eulogy is not just a bunch of words to glorify the person who died. It is also to comfort those who are alive.
So I understand. So you're
a person.
Yikrit the Shech, the Chayan.
Right.
Yeah,
so if a person committed suicide, it's still possible to mention some of his achievements and at the same time speak about the horror of life that causes a person who's weak to succumb to.
Well, you're on very thin ice in the last part, because at that moment they don't want to hear about that. That will just add to their sorrow time and again. If you have to give a eulogy, you would have to give a very powerful one. Have you heard the story of my eulogy with the jailbird?
Yeah.
No. So you know that story. So that's
because you had information that they didn't have.
But you see, that is the answer. To make a very long story short, a balabas of mine dies in jail. And this guy was a forger, and he was involved in stock theft. He was involved in running a still. And it's probably the last funeral I officiate before he go in Aliyah. So here is a boy out of the Bronx. All his siblings are successful doctors, professors, English professors, etc. And I give this eulogy. He's like Moshe Rabbeinu, who saw the promised land and never got there. And after they bury him, the eulogy is over. I see his brothers and sister speaking aloud for me to hear. What an idiot the rabbi is. What an idiot. What a nut. I was a young rabbi. That's what he spoke about our brother. You know, mamish this Gemara, that I made up stories of Russia, embarrassed the family, a nice father, a criminal. So I called them over. I said, my friends, I see you're not too happy with my eulogy. Well, Rabbi, if you said so. I said, tell me, what do you know about your brother? When was he first arrested? 1942, was a bankruptcy, took a rap for his father-in-law. And I'd seen, when I spoke with the parole officer, I saw all his history. Then he got out of jail to fight in the war. And I said to them, tell me, what happened in 46, 47, 48? They said, Rabbi, we don't know. We didn't hear from him. But in 1950, he was back in jail. He was involved already in another theft and this and that. I said, let me tell you something. My eulogy was about 3 years of his life, 46, 47, and 48. Do you know where he was? He was in Egypt, a major in the Mossad, risking his life for what would become the state of Israel. And his biggest mistake was not coming in Aliyah. His wife was ready to meet him, had already bought a refrigerator. He didn't have refrigerators here. And he backed off at the last minute, told her, hold up, I'm coming home. And then, of course, he tried to make up for the time he lost with all the magnificent ways he learned in the Mossad. And with that, his wife pulls out of her purse his Mossad identity card. Let me tell you, those people, the brother, the professor, the brother, the doctor, the sister, they fell korim before a rabbi named Aaron Rothkopf. Rabbi, we didn't know. If we only had known, accept our apologies. And I fell Korim before the Gemara. Thank God that I eulogized properly and cannot be held accountable for what is said in the Gemara bracket. Very simple. When I had to go plead with the parole officer and ultimately with the judge and all that went on, his wife filled me in on his whole life story. So that became a mitigating factor in running 3 7-year sentences concomitantly instead of consecutively. And the judge mentioned that the sentencing, that I'm running it concomitantly, and I want to acknowledge the interesting material that his rabbi supplied me with. You should know, we corresponded in Hebrew. You know what that meant? Every letter he wrote, they had to bring in the local rabbi near the prison, who probably didn't understand the Hebrew anyway, but had to read the Hebrew and approve it for censorship. So it meant all the prison authorities knew he was carrying on a correspondence in the sacred language of Hebrew with his spiritual leader. Gentlemen, what a tshuva from Rav Ovadia Yosef. He ends up, 1 second, he ends up the tshuva. By the way, the story I told you is only a small part. This story is an unbelievable story with a continuity, but you'll have to read about it in my new book. It's a continuity on the power of Torah that if I didn't know it was real, if you told me the story, I would say you have an amazing imagination. But no, my story that I just told you. The truth I told you, it's Yabi Omer, Chelik Bet, Yoredeya. Oh, I didn't tell you that before. Chelik Yoredeya, Siman Chav Dalet. And Rav Ovadia ends off the tshuva, V'Hashem Yitbarach, Yibdop Ratzot Amo Yisrael, V'lo Yishma, Shod B'Sheva B'Guleinu, B'Ila HaMavet L'Netzach, U'Bal Etzion Gohel B'Mchera B'Yameinu, Amen.
Did he say the word Shod?
Shod B'Sheva.
So that means...
It means he was a master of modern Hebrew. You see, that's poetic. Rav Ovadia grew up on the streets of Jerusalem, and he worked in his father's grocery store, and he was a master of modern Hebrew. What I'm holding in front of me, we'll end off in a minute. This is a Xerox of the original printing of the B'Sam of Rosh, 1793. As we mentioned last week, it was printed 3 times, once in Germany, one more time in Poland, when 2 tshuvot were left out. One of them was the B'Sam of Rosh's tshuva on suicide. You'll see why when we get to it. And then it was reprinted in Yerushalayim in 1984. Now, with the Yerushalayim printing, the introduction and all that was added is set in modern type. But the Sefer itself is published even in the new edition, the 3rd edition, it's a photo offset of the original edition. So I have to tell you in advance, it's difficult for us to read. In other words, we are used to reading modern Hebrew, everything is spelled out, where they don't combine an aleph and a lamed to save money. I took a course in Bernard Verville Graduate School on Kitvei Yad, and they explained to us, whenever you found an aleph and a lamed combined, because it's very easy to combine them, making the second part of the Aleph into a Lamed as well, that was all done to save money, because then printing was by hand. Every letter had to be set molten lead. Now, it's a shame that they didn't publish it in proper letters when they reprinted it in Israel, but obviously the money was not there to do a new job. It would involve someone totally rewriting the Sefer, going through every letter. It would involve, I don't know, in the 1980s, I would imagine it was computerization already. If anyone can correct me, I'm welcome to a correction. But I would imagine, I may be wrong, but I know that the Encyclopedia Judaica that I worked on from 69 to 71, I know that our index was done by a computer. And we were told it's the first time any encyclopedia has been indexed by a computer. So I would imagine, I know my first book was done with typeset, but that was 71, 72. I believe already the Suva era, which came out, let's say, 10 years later, was computerized. So it's really a shame that we don't have a modern typeset on the entire volume. Now,
what are the two tshuvas that were left?
We'll come to.
One was suicide. Was the other Kitniot?
No. Kitniot was
driving the Shabbos.
The other one was the Shabbos problem with the driving. We'll come to it. Those were the two that were left out. But when we come to it inside, you'll understand why. Now, the original Besom and Rosh. Why was it called Besom and Rosh? Because he produced 392 tshuvot attributed to the Rosh. Besomim equals in gematria 392. He says that, and this was gathered together at the time of the Beis Yosef by a contemporary of the Beis Yosef, Yitzchak Di Molina.
The only copy of the Rosh, not the Torah.
No, the Rosh, he didn't copy, he claims.
Yeah, but he didn't do the Torah.
No, why should he do the Torah? The Rosh wrote Tshuva Halacha L'Maisa, so he copied these Tshuva, Rabbi Yitzchak Di Molina, who never existed. It's a funny name. We find a similar name once mentioned in a Tshuva of the Avkat Rechel, I believe, but it's not that name, it's not exactly. And as I said last week, Alfasi's theory, Yitzchak me Vilna, that it's Yitzchak Satinov, it's a tribute to one of the Maskilim who was a follower of the Berliners who came from Vilna. That theory has also been advanced. That's a play, it's a reference. It's giving you a similar sounding name, Modena, Molina, all that has been advanced theories why he picked on this Yitzchak Di Molina. But it's really, I mean, when you look at this, there's nothing to suspect. This has to be true. Now, then he wrote his commentary, Kasa Dahasana. Now, what is Kasa Dahasana? Beitza Daftet Zayin Omer Aleph. A pie of fish hash or flour. It evidently was considered a treat. Like we would say today, ice cream cake, whipped cream cake. You follow? Maybe in Israel they would say pita and hummus. I know my grandchildren get all excited with that. Pita and hummus. And in other words, this was an expression in the Gemara for something that was a delicacy. Why did he call it Kasa Dahasana? Meaning that I'm adding to the Tshuvat HaRosh and I am making it taste better. I am putting icing on the cake. Okay? Ice cream on the cake. I am making it better. Ani Hatzair, and who wrote the Kasa Dahasana? Ani Hatzair Shaul, then Adoni Moriva Rabbi Hagon Mei Mukurad, or should be Mukudar, I don't, it probably is a misprint here, because there's a Reish Dalet, unless someone can correct me, Hagon Ham Mukudar Tzvi Hirschneiro, Av Beitin Po Berlin. So that when you read the title page, there's nothing in the world that will make you think that this is a forgery. Now, I'll show you next week, as Rav Hashem, his introduction, the Haskama. Yitzchak, I have stuff for you, and tomorrow I have stuff for you too. The Haskama, it is an unbelievable job put together, Lekaber the Lutiferet.
I know you for over 50 years. I never heard you talk. Beautiful.
Thank you.
People are always claiming,
but say that they learn from the Besamim Rosh, they learn from Shaul Berlin. So to reiterate, I'm not going give me a chance to show you what happened this weekend, but to reiterate, what do we do today? The heart of, we finished out Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. I showed you an interesting comment in the name of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and then the heart of this year was the Rebbe Avadji Yosef. What a fabulous tshuva, Yabia Omer. But for rabbis, the worst part of the tshuva was not the Chatam Sofer versus the Chida. The worst part was when you're maspid, you have to tell the truth. And sometimes to tell the truth, it's Kashek Kriyat Yamsof. I showed you the title page of the original. I got this out of the Hebrew University Library. The original edition of the Besamim Rosh. Tomorrow, gentlemen, it's when I start the shiur, what I have to say in the first 5-10 minutes, you'll go, it's fabulous, fabulous. I'm going to deal with Professor Lieberman and Professor Heschel, and then I'm going to deal with my Rebbe, Mori Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and his younger brother, Reb Aaron Halevi Soloveitchik, B'ezrat Hashem. Now, did you notice who the star is of Friday's Torah tidbit? Yes or no? Rebbe Yishlam, you cannot believe all the calls I got over Shtuyot, but wow. Here I am quoted, and I have to tell you, quoted correctly. What they don't tell you is my Chiddush Torah on John C. and Don Gianfrido's catch of DiMaggio's Drive, the New York Times, in an editorial 50 years after the 47 World Series, said exactly the same thing. Someone must have revealed to the New York Times, Al Gianfrido, I know I was saying something wrong, Al Gianfrido's catch, 50 years, 97, they ran an editorial. What that catch meant, that every man has a moment. And Rebbe Shalom, I already said it in BMT 20 times over by that time. So if anyone wants a copy, you are welcome. Next, this is a copy of Dov Shurin singing songs that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandson telling off the world. It is fabulous. I heard it once. My grandchildren heard it. They said, pass it on if anyone wants. I passed it on. And here you have Reb Benzion Mutzpi. These are Sheurim given by a Sfadik master in the Mosaic Shul where Rav Ovadia speaks. Finally, Achron Chavir, only Chabad can pull this off. Remember, I mentioned in class that the Brooklyn Jewish Center, the most beautiful, elegant, conservative temple. That's why Chabad went to Crown Heights, because the sixth Rebbe asked his Chassidim, "What's the best area in New York?" And they told him, "You want to find the best area, find the biggest conservative temple." And today it's a big Chabad place, and Chabad is reaching out to all the Brooklyn members who were once part of the shul. They're celebrating 100 years of that magnificent building. There are historic pictures here. If anyone is interested, it is yours for the asking. Excuse me? Of course! Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das bedanya. Thank you.